MVP. What would you like to talk about tonight? Sorry to keep you waiting so long. You got it, Steve.
Good evening to you, Dick. Good evening to everyone on the wet net. No problem. First of all, I'd like to make a quick comment. Last week we were talking about the electrical circuit, and you guys were saying that basically, you know, when you had a problem, you can't have more than 120 volts to ground. Well, I should have never doubted you guys, because after the net, I realized you guys meant earth ground, not the ground system itself. So, I should have never doubted you. I should have known better than that. Let me let it drop, and I'll throw my question out to you. Okay, question. Basically, I'm trying to gain some knowledge on vacuum tubes, you know, different types of vacuum tubes I'd like to get into, you know, repairing old radios and stuff. Is there some sort of book I can buy that will give me, you know, like a layman's term, you know, layman's explanation on, you know, how different vacuum tubes work, you know, what do you got out there? You got triodes, pentodes, all these crazy different vacuum tubes, you know. Is there a book out there? And maybe you'd just like to throw a couple of quick words on how they work. You know, I don't need the six-hour explanation. I know it's probably quite involved, but if you could just give me a couple of words on it to get me started. Back to you.
Oh, boy, you're going back in history. No, it's a good subject, Rich. Steve, unfortunately, it's probably out of print, but if you go to a good technical library or if you look it up on the Internet, Google, I'm pretty sure one way or another you're going to have a copy of a beautiful, I think it was iMac book, called Care and Feeding of Vacuum Tubes, or Care and Feeding of Tetro Transmitting Tubes, but it was Care and Feeding. The whole series by iMac, Care and Feeding, gave you a lot of good, solid, ham radio-oriented information. The earlier issues of the Radio Amateur's Handbook has quite a bit of tube information in it. I think the later issues now probably do not, but I'm not sure. I haven't actually checked. The RCA Transmitting Tube Manual is another rather good manual, the big red book. Not a very big red book, but it's a medium-sized format red book, smaller than 8.5 by 11, but it's probably out of print. But again, I'd like to believe there's a website somewhere that's going to give it to you. I'll give you a real quick thumbnail sketch as to how a vacuum tube works. Stand by. Almost all vacuum tubes, hollow state devices, as sometimes people call them, have a heater, a filament voltage, which makes the cathode hot. The cathode is willing to boil off electrons because it's hot. The plate usually is highly positive, numbers like 200 volts, all the way up to 2,000 volts and beyond on the plate. Screen grid is also another positive grid. It's a grid of wire, literally almost halfway between the cathode, which is usually the center of the tube, and the anode, the plate, which is on the outside of the tube. Most tubes of the kind you are caring about are built in a coaxial manner. If you look at the tube top view, in many cases the filament and the cathode structure is a tube going down the center, just like the center conductor of a coax cable. And the outer conductor of the coax cable is the plate. And in between, there are a couple of other circular devices called grids. Control grid is the one that has the most amount of influence. Screen grid has a lot of influence. And voltage on the plate has a lot of influence. And if you look at that control grid, at the one that's closest to the cathode, the inner ring, so to speak, around the cathode, as you put positive voltage on that, it literally draws electrons off that cathode, and they go flying through the wires of the grid toward the screen grid and toward the plate. And so by putting positive and negative voltage on that control grid, you're modulating the number of electrons that leave the cathode and go toward the plate. During the instant of time that positive voltage is on that control grid, lots of electrons leave, and there's a whole lot of electrons hitting the plate, and they create plate current. During the time there's negative voltage on that control grid, those electrons that want to boil off the control grid are being suppressed. They are negatively charged. If the grid is negatively charged, it repels them. Let me drop. You've could say it pushes those electrons back down toward the cathode. They don't hit the plate, and now the plate current is very small or zero. Once you recognize now that that control grid can control the amount of electrons going between the cathode and the plate, it's acting like a valve that you open and close very rapidly. That's why the British call the whole damn vacuum tube, they call it a valve. And to a degree, they're right. And by that modulated current on the plate, you now have some kind of a resonant circuit on the case of transmitters on that plate. Since that plate current is going up and down, it induces a voltage across your plate tank circuit, pi, L, T, whatever it is. Your resonator connected to the plate experiences that variation of current coming from the vacuum tube. A great big voltage is developed across that plate circuit, and by some kind of an impedance matching network, a portion of that voltage with the right impedance match is applied to your output transmission line. It goes up to the antenna, radiates a beautiful signal into space. That signal in space goes over to the guy you want to talk to. It pegs his S-meter, and after that, conversation takes place. So that's a quick thumbnail sketch of vacuum tubes. Vacuum tubes, let me drop. Lots of people today think that vacuum tubes are useless, that everything is going to be solid state. When it comes to receiver circuits, 99% of the time, they are correct. When it comes to transmitting circuits, wow, tubes are not dead yet, and they won't be for a long time. When it comes to kilowatt-level transmitting circuits, it's a lot easier and a lot cheaper to build kilowatt-level circuits with vacuum tubes. You can do it solid state, but you have to have a zillion protection circuits. The power supply is very difficult. The devices are very expensive. The heat sinking is very elaborate. And so a purely solid state, kilowatt level transmitter is a difficult, expensive thing. And if you look at the pros and cons, you might not want to go there. It's your choice. When it comes to very high power transmitting circuits that are used for military electronics, things like klystrons and traveling wave tubes, those tubes are going to be around for many decades to come, is my opinion. You take a look at many of those spacecraft that are out there, Voyager and the others that are way out there in space. Those are vacuum tubes sending that signal back from distances like Pluto. And some of those vacuum tubes have been in operation for 20 or 30 years, and they're still doing 75% of the power output from the day they were first manufactured. So properly used, vacuum tubes can give you a lot of power output, a medium amount of efficiency, a whole lot of life, a whole lot of bandwidth. And when it comes to high power circuits at, say, for instance, 10 gigahertz and beyond, vacuum tubes are really the way to do it. If you want to develop a whole lot of power at 10 gigahertz and you want to do it purely solid state, you better have a big bank account. That's a lot of opinions, been there, done that, and it's based on 40 years of experience of both kinds of circuits. Over to you, Steve, KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2EO, K2KEY.
Rich and Mel recognize that order. Steve first, go ahead, Steve.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, your quick explanation made more sense to me than about 20 pages of this old book I got here, and this thing is an oldie. This thing was copyrighted in 1929. It's just Principles of Radio by Keith Henney, H-E-N-N-E-Y-M-A. I mean, what you explained to me in 5 minutes made more sense than reading 20 pages of this book. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, Mel, we've got another happy customer there. We're going to have to send him a bill. And that's a joke, Steve. Rich, N2EO, what's your favorite vacuum tube manual? You got it, Rich. Wait for the beep.
Okay, Dick. Well, first off, I just went on Google and I typed in vacuum tube theory and vacuum tube principles. And I came up with tons of information, tutorials on vacuum tubes. That's the first thing. The second thing, I don't remember the name of the book. Maybe Mel. Mel, I don't know if you went to RCA Institute. I think you may have, or maybe I'll jog somebody else's memory. I don't remember the name of the book. It was a wonderful book. It was in the V7 program for ET21 and ET31, which is electron tube second term and third term. It was a thin blue book, and I don't remember the name of it. But if somebody can jog my memory, that was a good book that I'm sure he can get used. Back to net, maybe somebody who went to RCA around 1970 would remember that book.
Know what it is.
Mel recognized it, and I bet you the guys at Brooklyn Technical High School on DeKalb Avenue also used a real good book. Give us a little bit more audio, Mel. K2KEY, go right ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yes, there was a book called Introduction. Good name for it, Introduction to Vacuum Tubes. And I used that book. It was originally printed by Sylvania. Sylvania originally did put it out, but it wound up being paraphrased. I know that they used it in several different sources, including Brooklyn Tech. So I never went to RCA Institute. However, I did, I could say, learn my electronics started career, if you want to call it, at that point, was at Brooklyn Technical High School. And I could just basically remember quite a bit of the beginning of it because I did use it briefly when I was teaching basic electronics. I really just hit upon basic electronics because most of the people that I was instructing were actually going into communications, but as a Morse operator during the days when the Army was still using Morse code. So that basically was my thought, but I had to step in and teach some basic information on, you know, theory of vacuum tubes. I could give you a few words on it that may be of a great help how they started the book, Dick, over.
Sounds good to me, Mel. Give us a few of those words.
Okay. The way they started it is that they said that the simplest form of a vacuum tube is the one with two elements, known as the diode. And as with all vacuum tubes, it has a filament, and the diode also had cathode and a plate. And that is basically the form of a rectifier. When a heated, let me remember this, when a heated A battery to the cathode emits electrons, it is attracted to the plate. And if the plate is at a positive potential with respect to the cathode, that was the basics of a vacuum tube. So the basics also said that if the nature of thermionic conduction, the tube is actually, at this point, a conductor in one direction only. That was the beginning, how the basic tube being the diode, the two elements. As Dick said, if you add another element, they called it now the grid. And if you added that, it was called a control grid. Now, this became the three elements, or what is better known as the triode tube. Now, as they went on, I guess, I don't know if I should go any further, but we did go on to things like pentodes and tetrodes, etc. And I think I wouldn't, you know, at this point just say that much, but that was how they began, going from the diode to the triode. And basically, if you understand the operation of a diode, a two-element tube, and then it's very easy to fit in to the triode, which adds the third element, the grid control, Dick, over.
Very fine, Mel. If you want to look up a particular tube that contains a pair of diodes as a full-wave rectifier, the tube that Mel and I used a lot in our youth when we were cutting our teeth on vacuum tubes, was the 5U4, 5Uncle4, or 5R4GY, but 5U4 is a tube with a pair of anodes and one cathode made for full wave rectification. And if you study one of those diodes, one half of that tube, one plate and one cathode, during the time the plate is positive, the electrons that are boiling off from the hot cathode or filament fly through the vacuum of space between the two and current flows. During the other half of the rectification cycle, when negative voltage is on the plate, the electrons are being repelled, essentially no current flows, and therefore it's a beautiful rectifier. 5U4 was the tube that, let me drop, many television sets back in the old days that had a full wave rectified power supply with a transformer, where the secondary winding was something like 300 volts each side of center tap. Center tap got grounded. Each half of that transformer went to one of those two plates of the tube, and the cathode went to the bypass capacitor that became the filter network. And so lots of positive voltage was put onto that capacitor, and that became the power supply that ran the whole TV set. And so for the first decade or so of television sets, up starting in the 40s and getting up well into the 50s and early 60s, many good television sets worked that way with those diode rectifiers. So there's quite a lot to learn about vacuum tubes, particularly RF vacuum tubes. Very few people use tubes for rectifying anymore. Vacuum tubes today are used for high power transmitting and broad frequency response like traveling wave tubes. And so vacuum devices, I predict, are going to be around for a couple of more decades. They're far from dead. Let me drop. I've worked on a number of very expensive projects, usually of a military orientation for the Department of Defense, where some very forward-thinking individual said, hey, we've been using vacuum tubes in the XYZ system for lots of years. Isn't it time we get into the 20th century and go over to solid state? Well, for high-power transmitting circuits, you just try to take a well-established vacuum tube circuit and convert it to solid state. You would be amazed the number of problems they run into, the number of dollars they wasted, the number of years of development time they wasted, and the very low reliability they had for that particular function. High power, broad bandwidth, transmitting really is not the place to abandon vacuum tubes and go over to solid state. I've seen many attempts to do it, and there's great difficulty. So when it comes to your and my kilowatt level transmitters for ham radio operation, certainly consider vacuum tube circuits. A lot easier to service, a lot less expensive to buy, a lot higher in performance, in many cases higher in reliability. You got it, Steve. KC2MDP. Good question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, everything is tube here, N2EO.
Well, you're a vacuum, you're a hollow state man from way back. You got it, Steve.
WB6WW.
How we recognize, but Steve first. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate Rich's suggestion. And the book Mel mentioned, Introduction to Vacuum Tubes, just sounds right up my alley. Yeah, I'm basically going the same direction, I guess, Rich is, and Mel have gone. You know, I'd like to get into restoring some old radios and stuff, you know. Some of the old stuff that actually had character way back when. Thanks again, guys, and I'll give it back to you.
Somebody was mostly noise. I just heard a fraction of a syllable. You didn't make it on that transmission. Howie first. Go ahead with your comment, Howie.
Yeah, Tuesday, you might want to pick up the Amico Handbook, the old Amico Handbook, and any good text from community college going back to the 60s. Second comment, Dick. They still use vacuum tubes in front end of computers for the military in case they have any opportunity to like a computer or something like that.
Yeah, very fine, Howie. And Howie's right. There are a number of cases where vacuum tubes have a tremendous improvement in survivability for high impulse energy. Solid state devices in general, you give them a big enough pulse of energy, particularly in an electronic warfare environment, and they're quite vulnerable. And in many cases, vacuum tubes will survive a electromagnetic pulse, EMP. So you'd be amazed how many times they're still being used. The next person on our list was Richie. Let's hope the signal will be coming through. Richie, KC2LTY, go right ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, Richie's not there right now. Lou, N2YJC, what's going on in your neighborhood? And what tickles your fancy these days, Lou? You've got it. Wait for the beat. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, N2YJC. Couple of weeks back, Dick, I had signed on with a question or maybe looking for suggestions on getting my mobile automatic antenna tuner to tune on 80. I had stumbled on the fact that, when I originally installed the radio with the tuner and the antenna, I the tuner worked great up to 40 meters, and a couple of weeks back I noticed on a rainy day or when there was water or the ground was wet, the tuner would in fact tune 80, and that was the root of my question: is what can I do to possibly make the thing work when it's dry? Let me drop. Well, at any rate, there was lots of discussion and lots of suggestions, and one of which was adding capacitance to the antenna. Another one was making absolutely positively sure that the body of the truck and the chassis of the truck were bonded. In other words, they were one. And lo and behold, the weather started to cooperate, and I got out there and I made a capacitance hat for the antenna, and the thing actually started working. I was able to set the antenna tuner to do its automatic tune, and it took a couple of seconds, and it was able to tune. So I wanted to report back on that. Let me drop. I wanted to report back and let everybody know that suggestions were very good, and that along with I added a half a dozen heavy ground straps, braided straps between the chassis and the body, and also added a couple of straps to the exhaust system, because that's a long antenna that's only attached to ground way up at the engine, and put a few ground straps on the exhaust system maybe to help eliminate some ignition noise. I don't know if that helped, but I did put two straps on the exhaust system while I was down there. But at any rate, Dick, I had sent you an email with a couple of photos of the capacitance hat that I put on top of that whip, and it worked out real well. K2RIW and 2YJC.
Absolutely, Lou. I got that email, and as I studied your two different capacitive top hats, which look a little bit like a wire equivalent of a four-leaf clover antenna, or a three-leaf clover. I think it was a four-leaf. Your first two pictures, one of them was the larger top hat capacitor, which you said waved around in the wind kind of not so pleasantly, and the second one worked a lot better. On those two pictures, from what I can tell, the two top hats look kind of similar, but maybe one is really smaller than the other. And then your last picture was the back of the Yukon truck, where I can see the spring coil at the bottom of your whip that's doing all that mounting. And sounds to me like you've solved the problem. I think you said the standing wave ratio is now down to 1.2, and probably when the automatic antenna tuner does its thing. And I guess now the mystery is still a little bit of a mystery as to why it would change in the rain versus dry. Hopefully you've had a chance to try it both a rainy day and a dry day. And I wonder if the antenna tuner has to go to a new number, so to speak, a new tuning. And does it cover, when the antenna tuner does the thing, do you believe it covers the whole 80-meter band? Sounds like you're kind of successful, and you might mention what kind of DX you've heard so far in 80 meters. N2IJC, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beep.
Okay, Dick. Well, maybe the text and the photographs were a little misleading. The two photographs of the wire top hat are the same top hat. They're just two different angles. The first capacitance hat that I made, I used a stainless steel wire or rod, eighth inch diameter rod, about 12 inches long, and I had six elements going out like spokes, and tack welded those guys all together, and then made a little simple clamp to attach that to the top of the whip. But that was way too heavy, and the whip wanted to lay over like a limp piece of spaghetti. But at least I was able to test it, and that did in fact work. The clover that I made, I went to the clover idea because I switched over to some stainless steel braided cable that I had, very small diameter, like aircraft cable, which wasn't self-supporting if I put it out as a single element. I made the clover leaf design in order to help make it self-supporting, and so they would stay looking sort of like a hat. And the other thing that I thought of, let me drop. If I do, in fact, grab a branch of a tree as I travel down the road, these guys would be a lot more likely to flex and not try to take the tree with me. So that answers that. And as far as, the antenna tuner does its thing across the 80 meter, 75 and 80. Obviously, it still won't do 160, but I never expected to get 160. But it works well, and I've only got this accomplished late this past week, so I really haven't been out. I made several contacts on 80 meters, jumping on 2 meters and asking people to tune 80 meters for me and just confirm a contact, but I haven't been looking for contacts at it, got to go driving around at night to do that. But at least it works, and it'll be there for when I need it. Dick, back to net, N2YJC, and thanks very much.
When you go to Lou's placement on QRZ.com, you see a picture of Lou with now the antenna you just described. Sounds to me like it's rather successful. So you've got 80 meters up and running on a mobile automobile. The last question I've got is, I wonder if you've had a chance to operate it in the rain and on a dry day, and is there any difference in the tuning, or has that difference essentially disappeared with the latest setup? Back to you for a quick comment on that one, Lou.
The difference between a rainy day and a dry day has essentially disappeared with the extra capacitance.
It doesn't surprise me. I've got a guess as to what's going on there, Lou. Before, you were so far away from resonance on the whip itself that your antenna tuner had to really do a yeoman's job to try to take the highly reactive antenna. For all I know, that antenna had 2,000 ohms of capacitive reactance and 2 ohms of resistance. That's what happens when you got an antenna much too short. it becomes very low in radiation resistance in series with an extremely large capacitor. You go to the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, which you can find by going to the website where Mel and Dick have all their recordings. That's www.amateurradio.tangovictor. You go there and look at the Limon TechNet, and you look at the K2RIW section, you'll see the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. And what those curves are is every possible reasonable diameter and length of monopole or dipole-like antenna. What is the real impedance and resistance? What is the real impedance and reactance in ohms that you're going to see? They're on that graph. Somebody's done a man-year's worth of work gathering all that data for you way back in 1946. It's amazing how few people, let me drop, how few people know about that today. So that if you're setting up a dipole that's very fat because you're making it as a cage dipole, very skinny, because you're building it out of 35-gauge wire, very long, very short, near to the ground, far away from the ground, whatever. Almost all of those cases, with some obvious exceptions, are in that set of curves. So that on paper, you can design your antenna ahead of time, know what exact impedance it's going to give you, and then if the manufacturer of your antenna tuner has given you enough information, or if you designed it yourself and you're smart enough, you can calculate ahead of time, on paper, is it going to work even before you build it. Now, when it comes to putting a mobile whip that's much too small onto an automobile, you've got one more contributing factor, and that is there's some number of picofarads of capacitance between the body of the truck or automobile and Earth. And that's one more series reactance along with the antenna. So, and there's ways of modeling all of this if you really wanted to. Sounds like you've had a fun project there as you start doing more and more operation with that, Lou. Oh, by the way, what I was starting to say, let me drop, is that since your whip was so extremely small, and since the reactance of the true antenna, the reactive component, the capacitive reactance, was so extremely high that a very small amount of difference in the moisture that gathers right at that base mount of your bottom of your spring where you've got the UHF connector or the equivalent, the beefed up UHF connector, and that right angle below it, a tiny bit of water gathering there could add substantially to the capacitive reactance. When you got a capacitive reactance of, let me pick a number, 2,000 ohms, and maybe it was even higher, and you have a few more picofarads added by the presence of the water, and water's got a dielectric constant of 81, that would be enough to change the tuning. Now that you've got the top hat capacitor and the antenna is much lower in its reactance, you're much less vulnerable to that water at that junction. That's a guess on my part as to what I think is going on. Lou mailed us a nice set of pictures, and I guess if anyone wants to see how Lou set up his installation, in other words, some of you guys are dreaming about putting 80 meters or 40 meters on your truck, and you don't want to go through all the rigmarole of setting up a screwdriver antenna. Looks like N2YGC has solved the problem, and if you you get real nice to him and ask him for a copy of the photographs that he mailed me, he'll show you how he did it. And he did it rather inexpensively, and without a whole lot of extra work. There are guys who have homebrewed a screwdriver antenna. It's a very nice antenna, but a lot of hardware and a lot of work is required to build one. A fair number of dollars is required to buy one, and Lou has found a way around all of that. So before I put any more words in Lou's mouth, if anyone else is really interested in your, I'm going to call it breakthrough in inexpensive mobile 80-meter antennas, if anyone wants a copy of those photographs, if they mail an email to you, Lou, would that be possible that you could mail them the same set of beautiful pictures you mailed me? N2YJC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely. N2YJC at yahoo.com will get to me. I think that's how I'm listed on QRZ as well. And incidentally, I mentioned this the first time I was on the net with this subject. The antenna is a 102-inch stainless steel 11-meter whip. And part of the idea about that is
even though there's a 2-meter antenna on the car as well, trying not to advertise that there's a expensive amateur radio equipment, trying to make it look like there's just a crummy old CB in the truck and nobody would want to smash out the windows to grab it, so to speak. That was part of the consideration about not using a screwdriver or having a whole set of hamsticks or what's that other type, the Outbacker, which has got the wire jumper. You know, that stuff sort of grabbed your attention. Hopefully the 11-meter stainless steel whip, people are pretty used to seeing those with CBs, so you get the idea. Back to you, Dick, N2YJC, and again, real quick, it's N2YJC@yahoo.com.
Well done, Lou. That's a nice piece of work. And you've solved a problem that quite a number of guys have had over the years. How do you get a good operating 80-meter antenna on a vehicle, on a mobile vehicle? Okay, Wesley's the next person that's on our list, N2XJN. Wesley, if I'm guessing correctly, has a slightly controversial subject that he has been studying for, I'm going to guess, 6 months or so, and kind of exciting if it's real. Is it real is the interesting question. I'll let Wesley give us a few words on that one. N2XJN, K2RIW and TechNet. You got it, Wesley. Wait for the beep, and don't give us too much audio, please.
NWX2N, you have me down, right, Dick, for a comment?
Sure do. Oh, wait a minute now. You said comment. Oh, I may have, I know I've got you listed for a person that's going to be on our list of questions. Ooh, I may have bypassed you by mistake. I think you signed in before, Wesley, and I know you've got a comment. Obviously, I've got to go over to you, Paul. Sorry about that, Wesley. WS2N, you've got a call. And mention also if there's anything exciting going on in space. The latest issue of Scientific American that just arrived a day or two ago has got some rather nice stuff about astronomy and what they're discovering with these beautiful space telescopes these days. WS2N, K2RIW, you got a call.
Oh, okay. Very good, Dick. I didn't mind waiting around either, but I don't think this is going to take long. But this is a follow-up of last week's topic with the 60 hertz sound that I was getting from my television. You know, you can get this noise in any equipment, ham equipment or radios or whatever. This thing was actually in the TV for anybody that wasn't listening last week. And the idea was to eliminate this. I mean, it was not a loud noise, but enough to know it was there. You know, you could always hear it on every station or in between stations. You would hear this 60-cycle hum. So, as you remember last week, you thought, hey, I mean, that might be a problem because I ran a test toward the end of the year, and that recommended disconnecting the F connector, going to the cable box, and starting off with a voltage reading between that and ground, my house ground, which in my case I was using the water pipe in the basement. And sure enough, I had a voltage reading, and then we got right to the very end of the net. I was having trouble with my meter. I kept coming up with zero for amperage. I had one of the banana plugs plugged into the wrong port. Some of these meters you have to switch it out to get amperage. Sure enough, 0.47 amps was on that, or what's called close to a half an amp, and sometimes a little less. So let me drop the WS2N. There's nothing wrong with my audio. Fighting a bad cold here for last week as well. Dick, you thought maybe, oh, okay, it might be a potential problem, 7,000 volts, maybe from a pig transformer, a pig plate transformer, bad ground or something. Well, I did have LIPA come out, and sure enough, they showed up the very next day, and they ran a complete test. It was nighttime, but they didn't care. They took everything. They took the meter out of the house. They put bypass clips into the meters and checked with amp probes and voltage meters and check the grounds, make sure the grounds are balanced on both sides, 120, 120. He couldn't find any fluctuation. If you usually have a bad ground in the house, he said sometimes there's like a fluctuation, something will move with that voltage reading. It was very steady, 240 across the red and the black. So, he said everything's good. Let's go up, over to the cable line. He puts his amp probe around the ground connection going to an outdoor water pipe. And sure enough, there's 2 amps going across that. Everything's disconnected. I go downstairs and I check my meter. Half amp. I'm still getting a half amp on the S connector to the ground. So, I mean, collectively, it was like 2.5 amps. 2 amps going through this pipe outside and another half amp inside. So, naturally, he recommends immediately calling up Cablevision to have them straighten it out. I did, but that took them 3 days to get here. Let me drop it. So I got the okay from LIPO, but they're very good, by the way. They're like top banana in the world of the phone companies and Cablevision. And, these guys, I can't say enough about how much they checked when they were here. Thoroughly checked out, though. It's a terrific job. Cablevision, they came out and right away, now that they decide to send a supervisor because it's supposed to, be a little off the beaten path. So this guy comes out and he decides to check things. That should be there. That 2 amp on the ground. There's nothing wrong with that. Well, let me see the hum inside. By the way, we had gotten rid of the hum a week or two before with the another guy that had come from Cablevision, and all he did was take my 3-prong ground from the TV and put an adapter and basically eliminated the third eliminated the ground for the TV. I got 3-prong sockets in my house, and it's never been a 2-prong socket house, but he decided to put this gray adapter in that of course eliminated the hum. But I didn't like it because now I didn't have full protection for my surge protectors. We talked about that. Let me drop it. WS2X. Okay, and now the end result now is that supervisor decides to reverse the plug in the living room, and sure enough, the hum comes back. He said, that should be there. I said, no, it should not be. So that, naturally, I had a problem, and then showed him everything downstairs, and then I even showed him how I could take a 2.5 watt light bulb, one of these little screw light bulbs, and I put it in line between the F connector. I disconnected his F connector and everything. Between the F connector and my ground, which is only like 20 feet away from each other downstairs, and sure enough, this light lights up bright as could be. I showed him the amp meter, I showed him the volt meter, and even I think, showing him the light, that's going to, make the hair stand up on his head. Oh, well, I could hook that up to any house. I said, oh, my gosh, here we go. I said, this guy didn't even like the light bulb idea. So I said, we got to do something here. I said, this is not acceptable. So he calls up, and he has a technician come to change the outside ground setup. I told him I don't like the ground setup. It was one of these, like, plumber straps. I mean, it was a ground connector, but you'd have to see it. It looked pretty ratty. So he says, change out that, he tells the guy, and then I'll go back to the office and we'll figure things out. Well, he changed that ground strap, got rid of that, put on a real nice cast-looking copper type of ground strap, real nice thing, and new wire and all. And sure enough, that I took voltage readings, amperage readings and all, and everything's gone. Let me drop it, WS2N. Everything now is completely gone. And then just to be sure, because now I don't know when they're ever going to come out. I know they must have a problem in the ground and out in the box somewhere. Just in case that ground situation ever gets worse or whatever, to put a little extra ground protection in my house. They have these little connectors. You bring one, multi-connectors, and you can come out with like 2 or 3 TVs. I got one of those downstairs in the line. It has a ground connect, a nice ground connection on it. I went with a 12-gauge wire, put that in there, and just ran it over to the my ground cable attached to that, and then gave myself a little extra ground protection, because I did switch one time, and it was like I don't know, maybe 1 or 2 tenths of an amp, some very low number. I couldn't hear anything on the TV, but rather, you know, to better be safe, sorry, I just added more amperage, more cable to cut back on the any possible amperage that might get into it. Check this all on a oscilloscope, by the way, before and after. An old Heathkit oscilloscope, and it showed, you know, I stopped it, and I got really a fine wave. When I stopped it, it comes out, looks like a cosine, a jagged cosine wave, by the way. Not a nice, smooth one, you know. So I did that, and now when you check that with the, you know, go to the same connectors, after this is all done, and ground, all the grounds are done properly and everything, I mean, there is nothing on that oscilloscope. I never changed the settings. I mean, it is a straight line. And then, you know, you disconnect it. And it's the same thing as if you, like, short the connections together. You know how you get that straight line? And that's what you get now, straight line. But, I don't know, Cablevision, they really wanted to run away from the problem. I mean, in the long run, they actually fixed it. But he did want to run. I even told the guy, I mean, this is like taking two wires to a long piece of pipe and hooking up one wire to one end, one end to the other, and lighting a light bulb in the middle, a little 2.5 light bulb. but he just didn't want to, I think they try to avoid these problems. As far as grounding for Cablevision, I'm not going to give them an A-plus anymore, Dick. And I think they've got some grounding issues. I can't be the only one in the neighborhood, you know, in Long Island with this problem. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Bios don't have this thing coming in.
Interesting, Paul. How about that? Now, the one thing that's not clear to me is that when you first measured the current from the RG6 cable with the F connector, I think you told me you saw 0.47 amperes. And then during some other test, which wasn't clear, you saw 2 amperes, and you're predicting that when you put the two together, it's 2.47 amperes, or 2.5 amperes, you said. What were you going between when you measured 2 amperes, and do you believe that the improper connection to the grounding rod of the Cablevision system, the RG6 cable coming into the house, was that a contributing factor? But where did you measure 2 amperes? What made that go away? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW in the tech net. Wait for the beep.
Okay, amazing. I didn't time out the whole time. Dick, the Cablevision, I believe, still has a problem. You know, they have these amplifiers everywhere. And my guess is they're running the power, you know, and they probably have a ground out there. And some of that is coming into using my house as a ground. And I believe that's still there. I don't know. Again, I don't have an amp probe with the clips on it. But, they never came back. So that's probably still there. So to eliminate that, yes, good grounding at my house.
Verizon does not use a metallic signal input. You won't have no ground problems with them.
That's where the problem is being solved. If I was them, I would be fixing any kind of ground problems that I have, because I know that's still on the line. They're still wasting 1.5 volts and 2 amps 24 hours a day on my house, and probably millions of many other houses are probably doing this. They're wasting their electricity. I mean, I guess they don't care about paying the logo, but, I guess it would add up. So that's what I think's happening there. I'll probably never know. I really don't care. As long as it doesn't get into my house, that's the way I think. It's out in the street. That's their end. The way I come up with that is, if I'm not mistaken, let's say if you take 2 points of that are parallel, resistors that are in parallel, and you measure the amperage on one and the amperage on the other, you would add the two. to get the total amperage, you know, that with the formulas that we've all studied. Let me drop it, Dick.
Go to Verizon.
No, I don't want Verizon. I got other reasons for that. Let me drop it. Okay. I like Cablevision. Okay, here's a line coming in, the ground of their, or the shield part of their connector coming into the house. Now, that's grounded outside. They have a grounding clip. And then it continues into my house. Well, from this grounding clip from the shield, there's a wire, number of 10 wire, whatever it is, that goes from there over to a pipe ground outside, actually, tied into the pipe for the hose bib that comes through the house. So that's one connection. That's where LIPA measured the 2 amps multiple times before they shut my power down to the house and after. And then after they put the power back on again. That's where the 2 amps is. You go into my house, and go downstairs, and then before all this work was done, and you measure between the F connector in the basement before it goes upstairs to the TV set. You measure that ground, the shield of the F connector, back to the pipe that's got the grounding clamps on it, that the electricians have the grounding clamps on around it, about a meter. And if you measure that measurement, that's where I'm getting the, let's call it one half an amp. So I'm taking, it's, to me it's like two resistors in parallel. I'm taking a half an amp there and 2 amps upstairs. And that's where I'm coming up with 2.5 amps. I think I'm doing that right there. But I can't check outside anymore. Downstairs I can check. I may check after the work is done. And 0, 0 everywhere. Big difference. Of course, I can't light any more light bulbs up either. And outside is probably 2 amps. I don't have a clip-on amp. Not yet. I'm going to get one. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, Paul, what was the voltage in 2YJC?
Very low. Very low. By the way, it always fluctuated from hour to hour. Let me see what I have here. Voltage. AC volts. AC volts 1.8, AC amps 0.47, half an amp back here.
Interesting. So, if I understand correctly, what Loco discovered, what you discovered with the cable vision there, is that 2 amperes worth of grounding-like current is flowing from their system into your water pipe. Interesting. And that in turn, before they improved the quality of the grounding that they had previously established, until they improved it, that was creating hum in your audio system, that either half ampere or 2 amperes. Now with the improvement in the integrity of that grounding wiring, although still 2 amperes is flowing from Cablevision's system into your water pipe system, at least as long as it's well grounded as it enters your house, I presume now you can eliminate that gray mechanical isolator, your third prong of your television set, and the cable vision box are now being properly connected to the socket in the wall, and you no longer have the hum pick up in your audio. Fascinating. So I think you're saying that LIPA was declaring that multiple amperes of current from cable vision into your water pipe system ground, LIPA considered that improper. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Oh, yeah, definitely. First thing I did. Now, the supervisor, he leaves. He's in a mad rush to go somewhere. And he leaves, he calls up, has the technician, a regular worker, come by. And he Right, he tells them what to do. I mean, this guy, 100%, no problems, bolted it on, asked me everything's okay, reversed the plug on my, you know, pull that right adapter plug out of the TV. No hump whatsoever when I plugged that in. And perfect, you know. So, I don't know. I mean, the supervisor's a nice guy at all, but give me a mechanical. I mean, 5 minutes, he's done. The other guy was here, he must have been here an hour, going on and on. So, yeah, give me a good technician any day. He said, no problem. I warned the guy, by the way. I told him, hey, you know, the viper was here. They have two amps running through that. You know, be real careful. You're taking apart. I don't know what your voltages are out here. I know it's only one and a half or something inside, but, you know, I gave him a heads up on that. My guess is probably 2.5 amps now flowing in that cable. You know, because now it's eliminated from downstairs. It had to go somewhere. It's probably, if you put that a good meter on there outside, it's probably 2.5. But that way, that fluctuated too. So, you know, sometimes it was 1, 2. You know, it's just a, you know, you come back 12 hours later and you can barely light the light bulb. The amperage was down to like 0.25 or something, which is like a quarter. So things, it was a bit intermittent. My guess that it's bad, I don't know. That's actually not my guess. It's LIPA's guess. Let me drop it. By the way, LIPA documents this. He puts this on computer. You know, if you call up, he told me to tell Cablevision, you call up. They have everything on record. I think it's a very thorough group. They're very good at what they do. I was going to say something, but that's
tonight at 8 o'clock.
Pack music, WS.
W2VL repeater.
Yeah, the Ham Radio University last weekend, or was it the weekend before, mentioned the fact that there's a particular person at Long Island Power Authority, Mike Malowski, I think is his name, don't know his call letters, who's a ham radio operator, might be N2QOY, N2 Quebec Oboe Yankee. I might have him confused with somebody else, but that particular person is very good at finding grounding problems and any kind of wiring problems that are creating electromagnetic interference to ham radio equipment. Sounds to me like you've got an extremely improved system, Paul. A little bit mysterious as to why that much grounding current flows between Cablevision and you, but at least with good grounding, I think you're relatively safe, and it's nice that the hum went away, and it's interesting that the hum is what got you into this investigation in the first place. When that person replaced that wiring, he did have to open up that connection, and you gave him the heads up that there could be an extra voltage appearing. Did he do it with insulated gloves or with one hand in his pocket? What did he do if you happened to watch him replace that not-so-good grounding system? What did he do to protect himself during the time he opened that connection, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Vic, I didn't watch him. I really didn't. I let the guy do his thing, you know. Unless he calls me over for some reason, like Viper did. He called me over different reasons to look at the his different meters and all. You know, that's not one to hang over somebody's shoulder. Being out in the field myself, I find that a bit unnerving. So I'm sure they probably do too. But you know, I just let them know. I'm sure they know what to do. Dick, he thanked me for letting him know. That's all I know. Talking about thanks, I think it was Wesley that said, that amperage would probably be impossible or something last week, and you said I might have the different settings, right? My amperage might be, selector might be in a different spot, counting zeros and all, so yeah, two things there. Had the banana plug. You gotta pull the banana plug out. You gotta put it into this amp probe section to make the amperage section to make that work. So that's why I was coming up with zeros. Which pen in that? You got to switch back and forth. And when you want to check voltage, you got to go back to the other side. And then Mel said, "Hey, use a light bulb." I remember him. You know, he got in between transmissions.